Hello and good afternoon. My name is Tim Johnson, and I want to thank you for coming to the Marfa Book Company this afternoon. I also want to begin by thanking Ballroom Marfa and the Washington Spectator for putting together this incredible weekend of activities. I've already found it very thought-provoking, and I'm sure you have as well. Before I introduce our guests this evening, I'd like to invite you to a couple of other events, two today and two next week. Oh, let me also say thank you to the Marfa Public Radio for streaming and airing all of these talks. This one, in fact, is also being aired for those people who can't be with us this afternoon. After Rebecca Solnit talks here at 1 p.m., we're going to have Tom Rand. He'll be talking at 3:30. It'll be a kind of multimedia presentation. So after this talk, if you don't mind stepping outside briefly while we kind of rearrange the interior. And then, of course, Cynthia Hopkins will be giving a performance tonight at the Crowley Theater at 8 p.m. And then I want to invite all of you who are still here on Wednesday to come to the bookstore at 7 p.m. We're going to be hosting a tribute to John Cage on the 100th anniversary of his birth. We're going to be doing a community-wide performance of 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which is, of course, his famous silent piece. And that's co-hosted by us with our friend Alice Santoro. We'll also have a couple of other pieces being performed, including a piece called Tuning Meditation by the Houston-based composer Pauline Oliveros. And then on Friday at 6 p.m., we're hosting the writer David McDonald, who is based sort of right outside of Valentine. He'll be reading from his new book, The Last Great Ape, which is really excellent. So I hope to see you at some of these things. So when Aaron Kimmel told me that Rebecca Solnit was coming for this symposium, I was extremely excited, I have to admit, and so much so that I feel like I should probably measure that enthusiasm here. But I'm going to tell it as straight as I can without being overwhelmed. Rebecca Solnit is a San Francisco-based writer and activist, and she is the author of 13 books. She is also, and two forthcoming, she's also a regular contributor to a number of magazines and journals, including Tom Dispatch. And in the last 2 weeks, a piece of hers reappeared after a few years, which sort of tore through the internet. And it was a piece which, in a way, addresses this phenomenon of mansplaining. And I imagine at least half of you in the room will immediately know what that means, and the other half of you need to read this article. To give you a sense of the power of this work that Rebecca has made, a recent artist-in-residence, who is a friend of ours, asked me to tell you that he didn't think that any of his films would have been possible without Rebecca's A Field Guide to Getting Lost. Not that he couldn't have made films, but he wouldn't have made the films that he made. And another recent artist-in-residence, Esther Partagas, during one of our first conversations, she said, "I need another book like The River of Shadows by Rebecca Solnit." And I imagine most of you sort of know this moment. It's not a moment where this is this book right here, which is about Edward Muybridge. In that moment, you're not asking for another book about Edward Muybridge or even another book that has the kind of adventurous sort of inner architecture of this book. But you're looking for a book which invites you to sort of reconsider some aspect of the grounds of your experience. This is the sort of book that this is. And that's a really tough request. And I have found that the best course of action is to recommend another book by Rebecca Solnit. And then I just want to mention one more book before I give Rebecca a chance to talk. Hamfish published this book, Hope in the Dark, in the early 2000s during the first Bush administration. And I got to revisit this book in preparation for an interview with Rebecca that we did for Marfa Public Radio. And first of all, it's worth saying that the book begins by reminding us that our sort of fear of our future is in some ways just the fear of the future, of the unknown. And it goes on to sort of remind us that we inherit this remarkable context of all kinds of struggles, the participants for which had in their own times their own fear of the future. And they were able to face that and to provide us with the best aspects of the life that we live here and really all over the globe. The last thing I want to say is that I also realized that it's not only a book about hope and encouragement, it is also in many ways a wisdom book. There are all kinds of really interesting linguistic formulations of actual wisdom, and I imagine you know just how special that is. So please welcome Rebecca Solnit.
Thank you so much for stopping before I blush to death, Tim. And thank you all for coming and having a really great time. I will be back, which sounds a lot like my ex-governor when I say it like that, doesn't it? And I really want to thank Ballroom Marfa for bringing me here, but also for making an incredibly overwhelmingly rich and interesting and engaging weekend for me, and I suspect for almost everyone here. So I'm a great believer in books. When people tell me books are going to die out, I say that if we're going to go into the new dark ages, I'll be an Irish monk. There will be books. There might not be as many at certain points. And so I'm a great believer in books. But I had a non-book experience that was pretty profound in 2003, right around the time when the war broke out in Iraq, which is that I was dealing with another magazine, and they told me, like, oh, you know, we started putting stuff out on the web. If you have anything urgent and topical you want to put out, you know, give it to us. And it has this kind of great immediacy and reach and goes viral and all this stuff. I'd never put anything out on the internet. In 2003, technologically speaking, was a really long time ago. And I was surrounded by people who were full of despair that the war broke out. And the despair was based on a bunch of kind of false calculations. It was true that the war had broken out and therefore we hadn't stopped it. But they extrapolated from that we hadn't done anything, and that was extremely not true. We had, in fact, delayed and changed some of the nature of the war and brought the spotlight onto some of it. Countries like Turkey backed off immediately thanks to citizen outcry. Other nations withdrew later, Spain, for example. But then so many of the people around me who had been so against this war also tended to feel like, you know, not only did we not stop the war, not only did we do nothing, but we never had done anything. We had no power, you know, that it was all utterly futile. I'd been an activist for a long time at that point, and I'd watched a lot of things change and really seen some remarkable things happen in my lifetime. Nothing more than the work I did with, you know, than what I saw by working with Native Americans around the quincentennial and after, and seeing the whole definition of nature change as we went from thinking of nature, we in the dominant culture of nature, as this kind of other non-culture in which human beings didn't belong, to really accepting that this had always been inhabited territory before we colonized or put a little fence around it and called it wilderness. And I saw so many things change around it. I'd watched a lot of victories, including the great victory near here, the Sierra Blanca nuclear waste dump that never opened. Some of you may remember. And realized that a lot of victories looked like nothing. So much of what we achieve is what doesn't happen. The kids who don't get asthma because the incinerator didn't open in their poor neighborhood, the toxins that didn't get dumped, the GMO wheat Monsanto never introduced thanks to the farmers of South Dakota, and so forth and so on. And so I wrote this essay on hope, and the people who promised me they could put out all the way were like, well, we think we'd like to put it in the magazine. It'll be out in September. And this was April, and the war was like less than a month old. And I was like, no fucking way. And I sent it off to somebody I'd never met before. There's this amazing website everyone should subscribe to called tomdispatch.com that Ham and I have been mentioning repeatedly. It's this guy who's a book editor who started a little circulating things he was reading after 9/11. He's a lifetime Manhattan resident. And that turned into kind of what nowadays we call a blog, although what he writes is much more elegant and essayistic than that kind of strange yardage we call blogging. And so I sent it to Tom, and I think the way that the woodchuck is sort of Michael Pollan's generative story, the hilarious day I first sent something to Tom is my sort of my generative story for this phase of my life, which is that I came home after being out all day, having sent it off to him in the morning, to an answering machine message that said, this is Tom Engelhart, this is my home number, call me immediately and don't read my email. So of course I ran to my computer and looked at my email where I got a total brush off, and I'm really busy, I don't take unsolicited things, good luck elsewhere, and which I send to him on that anniversary every year. So, but Tom says he has no idea why after sending me the brush off, he actually read it. We put it out as soon as we could. It was the first thing I'd ever done on the internet. It went viral. We decided to turn it into a book. And that's how I saddled myself with the onerous responsibility of being the Hope Girl. That was hope, how Hope in the Dark was born. And it's also very much about how important a good editor can be to a writer. There's a kind of, I talk to Tom every week, pretty much. We correspond more than that. That's been going on for 9 years now. And somehow he calls forth my best work, I think. But, and the sort of continuing writings about hope, and hope for me is really, despair is about certainty, about the sense that you know what will happen next. And with climate, it's complicated because there are some scientific formulations that are pretty clear and have proven to be pretty accurate so far. But there's a lot of other variables and unknowns. But despair is a kind of confidence in its own way, that you know exactly what will happen, so you can give up now. It also lets you be really easy. Take life easy because it doesn't put a lot of demands on you. One of the things I've noticed after I, you know, became the Hope Girl. I spent 3 years traveling the country and being on the radio a lot. I probably did 50 public appearances and more than 50 on radio doing the Hope thing during the worst of the Bush era. And is that despair is kind of a privilege. You know, if you're a comfortable middle-class person, despair means you don't have to do a damn thing. You can go home and watch Cheers reruns. And what's more despairing than that? But if you're already desperate, if you're a starving campesino, if you're the farm workers of Immokalee in Florida, et cetera, despair means really surrendering to brutalization or starvation or profound depression. And a lot of those people are really hopeful. Hope isn't a privilege. It's a survival strategy. It's a weapon. It's not the same as optimism. Optimism is also a kind of confidence that you know what will happen next and it'll be fine even though you're not going to do a damn thing. And I'm not an optimist, but I am hopeful. So I wanted to read in the sort of ongoing annals of furious hope. A Tom dispatch I published about 11 and a half months ago, October 17th of last year. As the Occupy movement was heating up and as the Arab Spring was turning into whatever it's become and is still becoming. But so this is called Letter to a Dead Man About the Occupation of Hope. Dear young man who died on the fourth day of this turbulent year, 2011, Dear Mohammed Bouazizi, I want to write you about an astonishing year with 3 months yet to run. I want to tell you about the power of despair and the margins of hope and the bonds of civil society. I wish you could see the way that your small life and large death became a catalyst to the fall of so many dictators in what is known as the Arab Spring. We are now in some kind of American fall. The other foot of civil society has hit the ground running, and we're all heading towards a future no one imagined when you, a young Tunisian vegetable seller who's capable of giving so much and instead had so much taken from you, burned yourself to death to protest your impoverished and humiliated state. You lit yourself on fire on December 17th, 2010, exactly 9 months before Occupy Wall Street began on September 17th of this year, because your death was a beginning to so much. You lit yourself on fire because you were voiceless, powerless, and in a way hopeless. But you must have lit yourself on fire with one small hope left, that your death would make an impact, that you who had so few powers, even the power to make a decent living or protect your few possessions or to be treated fairly by the police, had the power to protest. You had that power beyond your wildest dreams, and you had it because your hope was the dream of the many, the dream of what we now call the 99%. And so Tunisia erupted and overthrew its government, and Egypt caught fire, as did Bahrain, Syria, Yemen. And in Libya, it turned into a civil war the rebels have almost won after several bloody months. Who could have imagined a Middle East without Gaddafi, without Mubarak, without Ben Ali of Tunisia? And yet here we are in the unimaginable world again and almost everywhere. Japan was literally shaken loose from its plans and its arrangements by the March 11th earthquake and tsunami, and that country has undergone profound soul-searching about values and priorities. China is turbulent, and no one knows how much longer the precarious discontent of the repressed middle class and the hungry poor will remain containable. India, who knows? The Saudi government is so frightened it even gave women a few new rights. Huge crowds of Italians are protesting austerity measures this month. Have I forgotten Israel? Huge demonstrations against the economic program in Israel all summer and into this fall. It's all about economics. This wild year, Greece boiled over again with colossal protests, demonstrations, blockades, outright street warfare, and governmental crises. Icelanders continued their fight against bailing out the banks that sank the country's economy in 2008 and began to try their bankers and their prime minister. Spain began to rise up on May 15th, and like so many of these uprisings, the participants were not advocating for one party or for a simple position, but for a better world, for dignity, respect, real democracy, for belonging, hope, and possibility. The Spanish young, whose future has been sold out to benefit corporations and the 1%, were nicknamed the Indignados, and they lived in the plazas of Madrid this summer. They occupied Madrid. In Chile, students outraged by the cost of education and the profound inequities of their society have been demonstrating since May, with everything to kiss-ins to occupations, to marches of 150,000 and more. And in August, in Britain, the young went on a rampage that tore up London and Birmingham and dozens of other places in an event that began with a police shooting of a non-white man. They'd risen up more peaceably about tuition hikes the winter before. Things are bleak there, but volatile. And of course, occupy the city, the London's sort of economic center, lasted for many months, and there's still some remarkable organizing going on there around the economy, around education, and around climate change. In Mexico, a beautiful movement against the drug war has arisen, triggered by the death of another young man and by the grief and vision of his father, left-wing poet Javier Cecilia. So there are mass demonstrations in Mexico again, too. And of course, I'm writing this a year before, you know, almost a year ago, before the Yo Soy 132 movement in Mexico and some of the other remarkable things that have happened. The village that drove not only the drug dealers and tree cutters, but the police out of their village. And like Oaxaca before it, ran it as a people's republic, a commune like the Paris Commune. We're sort of in a low-level global revolution, in case anybody forgot to mention that to you. And except for when it's a high-level revolution. There are places, I was in Japan this spring, where it feels like the old order has died and nothing new has been born yet. But everything is changing, and capitalism has never failed more spectacularly, nor has its obscenities ever been so spectacularly visible. Well, maybe in the 19th century. I sometimes think when Al Gore was running around saying all that building a bridge to the 21st century stuff, I had letterhead that said building a bridge to the 19th century as a sort of joke. And I now really feel that the Clinton and then the Bush administration built instead a real bridge to the 19th century. Because the kind of poverty, the kind of class divides, and the kind of obscene wealth we're seeing now is Dickensian, and the kind of labor conditions, the kind of greed. And to digress a little, and update a little. The United States had one great eruption in Wisconsin this winter when the citizenry occupied their Capitol building in Madison for weeks. Egypt sent pizzas to the occupation. And a crew from the Egyptian Association for Change marched last weekend at Washington Square Park, where a second Occupy has spilled over from Wall Street. More has spilled over from Wall Street. Thousands of Occupy presences are arising all over the North American continent, in Oklahoma and Tijuana and Victoria and Fort Lauderdale. In an era of privatization, is any resistance more appropriate than living in public, showing up and staying? We are the 99% is the cry of the Occupy movement. This summer, a flyer was made that said, And this is how it all began, with a flyer that said, "We the 99% call for an open general assembly August 9th, 7:30 p.m. at the Potato Famine Memorial, New York City." It was an assembly to discuss the September 17th occupation. The Famine Memorial, so close to Wall Street, is a memorial to the millions of Irish peasants who starved in the 1840s while Ireland remained a food-exporting country and the landed gentry continued to profit. It is a memorial to suffering, to the exploitation of the many by the few, to the forces that turned some of our ancestors, including my mother's four Irish grandparents, into immigrants, and that are still pushing people out of their nations, their regions, their farms, and their homes. The Irish famine is one of the great examples of the crises of the modern era that are not crises of real scarcity, but of distribution. The United States is right now the wealthiest country the world has ever seen, and it has an abundance of natural resources and of nurses, doctors, universities, teachers, houses, food. Ours, too, is a crisis of distribution. Everyone could have everything they needed, and the rich could still be rich. But they're greedy, and their 30-year grab has carved away at the minimum for survival and dignity for the rest of us. The Famine Memorial was a good place to begin. The 99%, those who starve during famines, lose their livelihoods and homes during crashes, were going to speak back to the 1% who'd been served so well by the Bush administration and by this era of privatization. As my friend Andy Kroll reported at Tom Dispatch, the top 1% of earners enjoyed 65% of all income growth in America for much of the decade. And in 2010, 20.5 million people, or 6.7% of all Americans, scraped by with less than $11,157 for a family of four. That is less than half the poverty line. You can't get by on less than $1,000 a month in this country, where a single visit to an emergency room can cost that annual income and a car or a year at college twice that. Later in August came the website started by a 28-year-old New York City activist, We Are the 99%, to which hundreds daily now submit photographs of themselves. Each of them testifies to the bleak conditions they find themselves in, despite their hard work, their educations, the promises dangled before them, that if they played the game right, they'd be safe, they'd be housed, they'd be dreaming that oversold dream. It is a website of waking nightmares, economic nightmares, a little wealth redistribution would eliminate, even without eliminating the wealthy. These people don't want luxury. They want to not be worked to death like 19th century mill workers, not to have their whole world come crashing down if they get sick. They want to survive with dignity, and their testimony will break your heart. Mohammed Bouazizi, dead at 26, to whom I'm writing, here is one of the most recent posts of that site as I write. "I am 26 years old. I'm $134,000 in debt. I started working at 14 years old and have worked full-time since I turned 20. I work in IT and got laid off in July 2011. I was lucky and found a job right away with a pay cut and more hours. Now I just found out that my dad got laid off last week after 18 years with the same employer. I have debilitating OCD and can't take time away from work to get treatment because I can't afford my mortgage payments if I don't go to work, and I'm afraid to lose my new job if I take time off. We are the 99%. Some of the people on the site show their faces at least in part, a middle-aged black woman, an old white woman, a young Latino guy, a skinny girl who looks nervous, a pretty bitter nurse with an unemployed husband, a 46-year-old guy with a dark mustache, a woman who couldn't afford to buy her 5-year-old a winter coat. But this 26-year-old white man in a gray T-shirt sitting in a window with a potted plant holds a handwritten letter so long that it obscures his face. Poverty obscures your face, too. It obscures your talents, your hopes, your potential, your voice, and if it goes deep enough, eradicates you by degrees of hunger and degradation. Poverty is a creation of the systems against which we're revolting this wild year. For the Arab Spring was an economic revolt. What were all those dictatorships for but to squeeze out as much money as possible out of subjugated populations? Profit for the rulers, profit for the multinational corporations, profit for the 1%. We are not goods in the hands of politicians and bankers was the slogan of the first student protest called in Spain this year. Your beautiful generation, Mohammed Bouazizi, has arisen and brought the rest of us along with them. Many critics seem to think Occupy Wall Street is a lobbying group that should create a package of realistic demands. This proposes that the occupiers become supplicants, asking the powerful for some sort of handout, college debt forgiveness, say. They're asking that a dream as wide as the sky be stuffed in little bottles for sale or for smashing. There is a terrible rage at the economic injustice that has gotten worse and worse, this rage that is shared by college students looking at a future of debt and overwork, and those who cannot afford college, by working people struggling harder and harder for less and less, by old people forced out of their homes by the bank's games with mortgages and profits, and by the rest of us furious on their behalf. And there is the joyous hope that things can be different. That hope has been fulfilled a little in the way that an open-ended occupation has survived 4 weeks and turned into thousands of occupations. In them, the voiceless have voices. The people isolated by failure find the victory of solidarity. It speaks for so many, and it speaks clearly, so clearly that an ex-Marine showed up with a hand-lettered sign that said, "This is the second time I've fought for my country and the first time I've known my enemy." The climate change movement showed up at Occupy Wall Street because the reasons why we aren't doing anything about climate change is the same damn reason as the rest of it. It would cut into profits. Never mind the deep future. Look to the quarterly earnings. The problem is big, and so is the common ground for opposition. A dozen years ago, in the wildly successful revolt against neoliberal economic policy in Seattle, the slogan that stuck around was "Another World is Possible." And for those who don't remember 1999 as wildly successful, just remember nobody was critiquing NAFTA then. If you're against corporate globalization, you're seen as some sort of, as Thomas Friedman put it, flat earth troglodyte. The WTO looked ready to be the most powerful entity the world has ever seen. I hadn't yet had the collapse ministerial it had in Seattle, the second collapsed one it had in Cancun in 2003. It hadn't yet begun to fall apart in so many ways because the uprisings in the streets encouraged a lot of the poor countries to resist the terms the rich were trying to impose on them. This was before the free trade area of the Americas ministerial collapsed in Miami with similar protests on the street by steel workers and us, the usual suspects, in a city that had been turned into a RoboCop Darth Vader future, but that also helped encourage the Latin American countries, which during the Bush era managed to stage their own anti-neoliberal revolutions, free themselves from the IMF and the World Bank and the Washington Consensus. All that stuff, these are some of the victories we don't talk about so much. These are the things that didn't happen, the free trade area of the Americas, the full reach of the WTO's power, and some of the other things that would have made the world much worse than it is, even though it could still be so much better than it is. So I was never sure about another world is possible, because in crucial places and ways, that world is already here. But on a YouTube video of the New York occupation, I heard an old woman in a straw hat with some flowers on it say, "We're fighting for a society in which everyone is important." What a beautiful summation. Could any demand be clearer than that? And could the ways in which people have no value under our current economic regime be clearer? Young man whose death gave life, whose despair begat hope. No one knows what the future holds. You did not when you set yourself afire 9 months ago. We do not know now about the long-term outcomes of the Arab Spring, let alone the American fall. Something like this arrives in the world like a newborn. A revolution is a baby, and we never quite know quite how it will grow up or whether it will live to grow up. Whether a human child or a child of history, we don't know what it will become, but we try to understand it by who it resembles. So I'm going to skip a little. So Zuccotti Park is just a block from Wall Street, but it's also just a block from the 9/11 site. The Arab Spring was a decade later antithesis of 9/11, the blow from the Muslim world. That nonviolent public inclusive revolt that forced the Western world to get over its fearful fantasy that all young Muslims are terrorists, jihadis, and suicide bombers. Then this is the other half of 9/11 in New York, one that began 6 days after the 10th anniversary. That is that Occupy Wall Street began 6 days after the 10th anniversary of 9/11. What was remarkable about that day 10 years before is how calmly and beautifully everyone behaved, helping each other down those dozens of floors of stairs in the Twin Towers and away from the catastrophe, then lining up to give blood and desperate to give, to do something, to participate, to be part of the newfound sense of civil society that arose that day. There was, for example, a huge commissary organized on Chelsea Piers that provided food, medical supplies, and work equipment for the people at Ground Zero, and also helped find housing for the displaced. It was not an official effort, but one even more spontaneously arisen than Occupy Wall Street, without leaders or institutions, and it was forcibly disbanded when the official organizations got their act together a few days later. Those who participated found in it, amid all the distress and sorrow, a tremendous joy in having meaningful work and deep social connections and a little temporary democracy. They had found their true occupation for a few days and their membership in civil society. When I began to study the history of urban disaster, I found that joy again and again, one that unites protest demonstrations, revolts, and revolutions with the aftermath of some disasters, not because of the losses, but because of the ways people rise and come together to meet the occasion. Since I wrote A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster, I've been asked over and over again whether economic crisis begets the same kind of community as sudden disasters. It did in Argentina in 2001 when the economy crashed there, and it has now in the streets of the United States. A sign at Occupy San Francisco said, "It's time." It is. I don't know exactly what this baby looks like, but I know that who you look like is not who you will become. This unanticipated baby has a month behind it and a future ahead of it none of us can see, but its birth can give you hope. Love, Rebecca. So, and I'm getting ready for, I love anniversaries. It's when time's cyclical, when we remember that the future is made out of the past. We retake stock of what we've done and how we got to this moment. And I'm preparing for the one-year anniversary, and I'm going to read you just a couple paragraphs from that, and then we're going to stop being all urban and revolutionary and have some country and Western. So this is for 2 weeks from today, September 16th. There will be massive demonstrations in New York and San Francisco on September 17th, and probably a lot of other places, but those are the two that I know about, and I'll be in the streets of New York on the 17th. Occupy is a year old tomorrow. A year is almost a ridiculous measure of time for much of what matters. At 1 year, George O'Keefe was not a great painter, and Bessie Smith was not much of a singer. 1 year into the civil rights movement, the Montgomery bus blockade was still in progress, catalyzed by the unknown secretary of the local NAACP chapter, an Atlanta preacher, by Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, in other words, by unknowns. Still, Occupy, our bouncing baby, was born with such struggle and joy a year ago, and here we are 12 long months later. Occupy didn't look remarkable on September 17th of 2011, and a lot of people were looking at it when it was just some young people in Zuccotti Park. But its most remarkable aspect was its staying power. It didn't declare victory or defeat and go home. It decided that it was home and settled in for two catalytic months. Then tents and general assemblies and the acts, tools, and ideas of Occupy exploded across the nation and the Western world, from Alaska to New Zealand to Germany and some parts of the Eastern world. Occupy Hong Kong was going strong a few weeks ago. For a while, it was easy to see that this baby was something big. But then most, but not all, the urban encampments were busted and the movement became something subtler. But don't let them tell you it went away. The most startling thing anyone said to me last year is, what is Occupy's 10-year plan? Who takes the long view? People think activism is a slot machine, and if it doesn't come up three jailed bankers or three clear victories right away, you wasted your quarters. Hardly any activists even define what victory would look like, so who knows if we'd get there. Sometimes we do get three clear victories, but because victory hasn't been defined or it didn't come immediately, hardly anybody celebrates or even notices. So, and another little scrap from this work in progress. We live in the heroic age itself, the age of Aung San Suu Kyi, of Nelson Mandela, of the civil rights movement's surviving members, John Lewis and Reverend Lowry, of so many unsung heroes and heroines. Their praises are often sung, or the famous heroes, praises are often sung, and courage, integrity, generosity of spirit, vision all matter. But I want to talk about another virtue we don't talk about much. It's the one we call patience when we like it, or it appears to be gentle, and call stubbornness when we don't or it doesn't. After all, Mandela didn't let go of his goals during 27 years in jail, and Suu Kyi has been steadfast nearly as long in pursuit of hers. During many years of house arrest and intimidation since the military junta stole the 1990 election that she won. And their goals seemed impossible at times, as did some of the goals of the civil rights movement, or for that matter, the abolitionist movement in the USA, which set out to eradicate the atrocity of slavery more than 30 years before victory. Change happens, it sometimes takes decades, and it takes people who remain steadfast for decades. I think the steadfastness of the heroes of the great movements of our time came not from facts, but from faith. They had faith that their cause was just, that this was the right way to live, that what they did mattered, and that they had all those things decades before there were results. You had to be unrealistic about the odds to go up against the Burmese generals or the apartheid regime or Jim Crow or 5,000 years of patriarchy or centuries of homophobia. And the unrealistic did, with tremendous consequences. Realism is overrated, but Occupy has already had extraordinary consequences already. We changed the national debate early on, and we obliged even the mainstream to call things by their true name: economic inequality, greed, corruption. We brought into the open what was hiding, both the viciousness of Wall Street and the yearning for community, justice, truth, power, hope that possesses most of the rest of us. We found out who we are, and that is itself most potent. Now to do something about it. So stay tuned. But that's enough of that strident stuff. And now I'm going to read from my book, a little bit of my book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost. It was so nice at dinner last night at Virginia's house. They were playing George Jones, which doesn't get played that often at dinners you go to in my part of the world, tragically. And it reminded me of this extended passage from the third Blue of Distance chapter in that book. So a little shift here. So that was the city and the brain. Now let's have let's have the country and some embodiment. Blue was the title I gave to a compilation tape I made a dozen years ago. And some of the songs were about sadness, some about the sky, some about both. Every once in a while I made a collection like that, mostly to be listened to on long road trips. And in them I tried to define what it was that moved me in the music I chose. An earlier one had been called Geography Lessons, Mostly Tragic. And there, too, I had tried to get at something about the evocation of place and its emotional resonance in that music. A compilation about rivers and drinking, about drowning from the inside and out, I called the entirely liquid Mr. North, after the fatally alcoholic composer Abe North in F. Scott Fitzgerald's Tender as the Night, though the songs were Southern. In Blue, most of the music has some relationship to the blues, as if the music was going back to its origins in longing in the blue of distance. I discovered country and Western music a few years before, and here, you country you and Western people have to pardon me. I'm an immigrant kid from the coast. I was raised up to believe that it was, you don't even want to know. There's a class war in this society, and a lot of it was, I wrote an essay once about it actually called "The One Nation Under Elvis," and that was about the way that middle-class white people despised working-class white people and pretended it was because they're all racist bubbas and that therefore this was righteous indignation. But it was just middle-class people hating poor people, and that we call that class war. And they were, you know, so. And anyway, I can't help it. It all is all political, isn't it? Is there anything that isn't political? Talk to me about that later. I discovered country and Western music a few years before, not the modern stuff that's mostly sentimental pop with fiddles and a twang, but the older tunes that plumb the dark depths of emotional experience. I'd grown up in immigrant coastal liberal culture, far removed from the realm of this music, and been taught to despise this stuff as banal, as trashy, as vulgar, without really listening to it. When the music burst upon me all of a sudden one spring, actually it was very political, it was the great anti-nuclear activist Bill Rossi and his guitar during one of our anti-nuclear things, he could play the entire Johnny Cash songbook and then follow it up with the entire Hank Williams songbook. He was an old Western Shoshone Iwo Jima vet who was a huge influence on my life and pretty amazing. That's how I came to country music. You go to be an anti-nuclear activist and you never know what you'll get. You could just get irradiated or, you know, you could get the entire Hank Williams songbook or a little of both. When the music burst upon me all of a sudden one spring, I was stunned to find out that the most popular songs often were, like the stories of Edgar Allan Poe and Catherine Ann Porter, a kind of Southern Gothic in love with tragedy and topography. Thinking about it now, I wonder about an era when a wrenching poetics of loss possessed the airwaves, and wonder too about how it slid over into the true banality of upbeat country, contemporary country, though there are still great balladeers around the edges of that genre. The songs that worked their way into my blood were like short stories compressed into a few stanzas and a refrain. They always spanned and layered time. The music was haunted, was about distant memory, was about the dead and gone, or at the very least aimed at a beloved far beyond earshot. Like writing, the music was solitary, talking to itself in that solitude of composition and contemplation, and the free flow of time that is before, after, between, but somehow never quite the now of a thriving romance. Perhaps this, too, was also the time of my long summer drives, of driving 600, 1,000 miles in a day, of unrolling again and again like movies, like stories, like the stories small children demand for reassurance, the sequences of Highway 40 through Arizona and New Mexico, 80 and 50 through Nevada and Utah, of 58 and 285 through the California desert, of many secondary highways and other roads, roads whose mesas and diners were always the same, and whose loud and light and clouds and weather never were. And this wasn't the obscure alternative stuff necessarily. At a flea market, I picked up a cassette of Tanya Tucker's early hits for a quarter, back when I was first poking around at what was to me a whole new continent. The cassette was like an anthology of stories. A former beauty walked around town, mad from loss, and stuck in a moment that had evaporated away long ago, carrying a suitcase and waiting for a man that had abandoned her long before. A nameless voice asked her nameless lover, "Would you lay with me in a field of stone?" Summoning up a bizarre picture of lovers in one of those unplowable granitic pastures. And the intensity of need seemed to be all the explanation the strange request required. Walking After Midnight, Patsy Cline's huge 1957 hit, is unsettlingly peculiar in the same way. I walk for miles along the highway. It's just my way of saying that I love you. Not a very domesticated or reasonable way. A woman recalled the man who'd approached her when she was a child. He asked her mother's name and whether she ever spoke of a place called New Orleans, and for bothering a child was thrown into jail. Near the present in which the song is sung, the questioner died, and his corpse was the note from her mother announcing her birth, so that the one meeting between father and daughter had been a catastrophe of non-recognition, of the failure to connect that is so much the material of these songs, the layer time like dirt on a grave. They were always about someone recalling a tragedy that unfolded long ago, generally about someone else, so that a sort of haze of remoteness lay over the once-wrenching events, the kind of time Joseph Conrad evoked when he'd set up a narrator on a dock ship, telling a tale of another man in another ocean long before, an unresolved riddle to be revisited. The quintessential song in this vein, and the one I love best, is Long Black Veil, a novel in 12 lines, which the protagonist sings from beyond the grave, 10 years after he is hung for a crime he did not commit, as his best friend's wife silently watched him die. How many of you know the lyrics of Long Black Veil? Oh my God, you ignorant people. Welcome to Texas. So I'm sure there's someone here who can remedy that for you before you leave. And they're probably over at that festival. We should probably test the Martha Lights Festival versus the Ballroom Festival for Long Black Veil knowledge and see how it goes. So The quintessence of Long Black Veil, which a protagonist sings from beyond the grave 10 years after he's hung for a crime he did not commit, as his best friend's wife silently watches him die. They'd been together in bed, but neither would invoke an alibi that would have saved him. And so, as the famous refrain goes, she walks these hills in a long black veil and visits my grave where the night winds wail. Even Bobby Gentry's 1967 Ode to Billy Joe, that mega hit in which the girl protagonist may have pushed her lover off that Tallahatchie Bridge below Choctaw Ridge, has something of that sense of looking at ghosts and wraiths in the rearview mirror of irrecoverable time, irrecoverable loss and error. The protagonists were often anonymous, nameless, described only in the vaguest terms. A man, a woman, a beloved dead, a long time ago, a faithless wife, a cruel husband, a hope abandoned, a dream glimpsed once and lost. But the territory in which these dreams played themselves out were evoked in detail over and over again. And if they were tragic songs about the failure of human love, they were also love songs about places whose names were recited like incantations and caresses. The names are just the facts of bridges, mountains, valleys, towns, states, rivers, lots of rivers, highways were recalled in reverie, and psychic states themselves became places, lost highway and lonely street. So though they were overtly love songs, in most of them the landscape was a deeper anchor for being, and the object of another more enduring love. The grave, the town hall lights, the hills and the gallows are all more vivid than the protagonists of Long Black Veil. Perhaps it's that you can't go back in time, but you can return to the scenes of a love, of a crime, of happiness, and of a fatal decision. The places are what remain, are what you can possess, are what is immortal. They become the tangible landscape of memory, the places that made you, and in some way you too become them. They are what you can possess and what in the end possesses you. In my old Tanya Tucker cassette, Brownsville, San Antonio, Memphis, New Orleans, and Pecos were the only proper names mentioned. Those streets, fields, rivers, stores, jails, ferries, and other locations also showed up. The people were nameless, and sometimes the women began to dissolve into places, like those tragic figures the gods would turn into rose bushes or fountains to stabilize their grief. There was, of course, the jilted bride called Delta Dawn, and far more scorchingly, there was the young rape victim who withdrew into herself and became known as No Man's Land. She grew up to be a beauty, a nurse, and one day she found herself called upon to nurse her rapist. The song is vague about the details, but she seems to have watched him die rather than treating him. And the refrain goes, "And now his soul goes walking in No Man's Land." It's a terrifying song about the damage people can do to each other and about the way the rapist comes to possess her twice, once as the soul who haunts the limbo she has become. The places in which any significant event occurred become embedded with some of that emotion, and so to recover the memory of the place is to recover the emotion, and sometimes to revisit the place uncovers the emotion, and this is as true of country and western as of Swan's Way. Every love has its landscape. Thus place, which is always spoken of as though it only counts when you're present, possesses you in its absence, takes on another life as a sense of place, a summoning in the imagination with all of the atmospheric effect, an association of a powerful emotion. The places inside matter as much as the ones outside. It is as though the way places stay with you and that... It is as though, in the way that places stay with you and that you long for them, they become deities. A lot of religions have local deities, presiding spirits, geniuses of the place. You could imagine that in those songs, Kentucky or the Red River is a spirit to which the singer prays, that they mourn the dream time before banishment, when the singer lived among the gods who are not phantasms, but geography, matter, earth itself. There's a voluptuous pleasure in all that sadness, and I wonder where it comes from. Because as we usually construe the world, sadness and pleasure should be far apart. Is it that the joy that comes from other people always risks sadness? Because even when love doesn't fail, mortality enters in. Is it that there is a place where sadness and joy are not distinct? where all emotion lies together, a sort of ocean into which the tributary streams of distinct emotions go, a far away deep inside? Is it that such sadness is only the side effect of art that describes the depth of our lives? And to see all that described in all its potential for loneliness and pain is beautiful. There are songs of insurgent power. They are essentially what rock and roll, an outgrowth of one strain of the blues, does best. Those songs of being young and at the beginning of the world, full of a sense of your own potential. Country, at least the old stuff, has been mostly devoted instead to aftermath, to the hard work it takes to keep going, or the awareness that comes after it is no longer possible to go on. If it's deeper than rock, it's because failure is deeper than success. Failure is what we learn from mostly. All those summer drives, no matter where I was going, to a person, a project, an adventure, or home, alone in the car with my social life all before and behind me, I was suspended in the beautiful solitude of the open road and a kind of introspection that only outdoor spaces allow. For the inside and outside are more intertwined than the usual distinctions permit. The emotion stirred by the landscape is piercing, a joy close to pain when the blue is deepest on the horizon, or the clouds are doing those spectacular fleeting things so much easier to recall than to describe. Sometimes I thought of my apartment in San Francisco as only a winter camp, and home as the whole circuit around the West I travel a few times a year, and myself as something of a nomad. Nomads, contrary to popular imagination nowadays, have fixed circuits and stable relations to places. They're far from being the drifters and dharma bums that the word nomad often connotes now. This meant that it was all home, and certainly the intense emotion that, for example, the sequence of mesas along the highway for perhaps 50 miles west of Gallup, New Mexico, and 100 miles east has the power, even as I write, to move me deeply, as do dozens of other places. I've come to long not to see new places, but to return and know the old ones more deeply, to see them again. But if this was home, then I was both a possessor of an enchanted vastness and deeply alienated. So were the people in those songs, and it seemed that place names had an evocative power there that they did in my life. I love to hear people say those names. Once when I was living in New Mexico, a student who'd lived in my part of California would charm and mesmerize me by saying Sebastopol, Occidental, Freestone, Gravenstein, Highway, Petaluma. Now it's the New Mexico names that have the most power over me. Golondrinas, Mora, Chacon, Trampas, Chimayo, Nambe, Rio, and Medio, Cañoncito, Stanley, Moriarty, the East Mountains, Cerrillo, Cerro Pelon. There's a whole genre of song that began in the blues that consists largely of place names, a recitative of geography, of which the famous Route 66 and Orange Blossom Special are only the most popular. Perhaps they came from the conductor's cries on the railroad, as does the list in the bluegrass tune Orange Blossom Special. Perhaps travel and lists are inevitably wed, so the music of restlessness paces itself in place names. An outsider's insightful approximation of its essence is Wanted Man, which Bob Dylan wrote in 1969, and Johnny Cash most famously covered. It's a beautiful list of all the places a criminal is wanted, a recitation that includes Albuquerque and Tallahassee and Baton Rouge and Buffalo, a confusion of being desired with being hunted that has unsettling intimations about the motives for committing a crime. The Australian rock star Nick Cave has a passion for the American South and its music, and in his songs it becomes a pure imaginary space of religious fervor, erotic passion, violence, and longing. He sang two of the great place name litanies with the passion of someone who longed not for the places, but for that longing itself. By the Time I Get to Phoenix and Wanted Man. And when he recorded the latter, he completed the song with the refrain of his own, "But the one place that I'm not wanted is the place that I call home." That life is a journey is a given in these songs, whose background is, after all, the urbanization of rural whites and northern migration of southern blacks. But the intense love of place frames this journey not as an enlightenment narrative of discovery of the unknown, but an insular tale of loss of the formative terra cognita that exists in the song only as memory, a map written in the darkness of your guts, readable in a cross-section of your autopsied heart. No one gets over anything. Time doesn't heal any wounds. If he stopped loving her today, as one of George Jones' most famous songs has it, it's because he's dead. The landscape in which identity is supposed to be grounded is not solid stuff. It's made out of memory and desire, not only rock and soil, as are the songs. Thank you. Thank you. I think we can do that. Any questions, comments? Anybody who can sing Long Black Veil a cappella is welcome to come up here and do so. I'm sure there. Oh, don't be shy. It couldn't be worse than being up here for a whole hour. Yeah.
Do you hang out with Real Marcus much?
With Real what?
Real Marcus. Have you ever read his...
Oh, Real Marcus. A little bit. A little bit. Yeah, yeah, no, I love his writing about some of the older American music. So, and he's not a close friend, but I cross paths with him and keep in touch with him a bit in the Bay Area, and he's a great writer. So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about the hope and sense of space and the balance of both? I like what you said.
Oh my God, this could be the 2-week seminar, but don't worry, it's not going to be. I think hope is, the funny thing is I wrote A Field Guide to Getting Lost, which I just read that country and western passage from, and it's a very introspective, melancholy book, and I wrote it right after Hope in the Dark. And one of the nice things about being a writer is you never really know what you're doing till after you've done it, and then you look back and the way becomes a little clearer. At the time I thought, you know, I'm all over the map, and here I should just add that every time I hear Michael Pollan, it's like, in my next life, I want to be a really clear, focused, coherent person. But, we all have our own row to hoe, and I think my row looks sort of like a zigzag with a curly Q and some scenic detours and a long digression and 37 topics and, at the outset. But, for hope for me... those two books were really about uncertainty. Hope in the Dark is about the fact that we don't know what will happen. And A Field Guide to Getting Lost is about embracing the unknowable, about the needs and values of getting lost, which I think a lot of people have seen as being about the creative process. But it's also about living your life. There's such... it was written earlier in the tech boom when so many people were singing the praises of all these technologies that meant you would never meet a stranger, you'd never leave your house again. And being out in public was always portrayed as either inconvenient, dangerous, or both, which was really kind of tragic because life happens out of doors, whether it's in the wilderness, or, in the country alone, or in civil society in the streets. And, and it's one of the ways I see people getting privatized. So these were both celebrations of just kind of coming to terms with the fact that there's so much we don't know. You know, if I told anybody on December 31st, 2010, that the three big dictators of North Africa were all going to be overthrown by, the end of the year, that the Arab world was actually just totally thirsting for democracy, that, nobody foresees anything. If I told you in 2006, like, relax about this George Bush thing, we're going to have a black president who's, the world is totally unlikely at every single moment. And the kind of odd coincidences and things, that bring it into being are part of what interests me, mapping these kinds of little unpredictabilities and encounters and conjunctions that bring most of us and most every moment into being. So hope for me, it's partly like, the powers that be would like us to think that we're powerless, although when you see how frightened Vladimir Putin is of three performance artists with balaclavas, you get reminded that actually we're very powerful and scary, and when we choose to actually do something. And, hope for me is about remembering the powers we have, the amazing victories we've had, some of which I've been mentioning this weekend, and the fact that the future is unknowable. But it's also kind of just a refusal to surrender. Despair feels like being co-opted or surrendering, giving up, becoming passive, etc. And, you know, like, it's a crappy way to live. And, you know, so hope for me is also about a kind of stubborn refusal to surrender, refusal to give up, which doesn't mean being stupid and banging your head against the wall. It means, you know, finding the door, figuring out how to carve one, or, you know, walk around the wall. At, you know, so that's some of the ways that I think about it. And, you know, and it's, I feel like most of the history that matters is kind of an untold history, that popular power, and, you know, just, which sometimes gets called nonviolent direct action or civil disobedience, wields a huge influence and has shaped the world immensely. And just as culture shapes politics in so many ways that matter if you pay attention, if you see the patterns, if you stick around. So that's kind of the hope thing, as I can summon it up off the top of my head in front of all these people staring at me. So, other questions or comments or, yeah. Nobody what?
No one knows how the drugs get up there, or no one wants to know. And no one knows what happens to all that cash, how it's going to be, everything else, but creates all the horrible destruction out there. Now, that was a pretty strong message. I looked at the audience of several hundred people, all well-dressed in suits. They were from energy companies, law firms, and the man from the Institute spoke stronger about this issue. And the people they really got it. The 200-300 people were stuck in the track. I was told to tell them both about that. That's my own.
Oh, good. Yeah, I wrote I do my Tom dispatches as letters sometimes. I wrote a letter last month to Mexico apologizing for the drug, for the narcotraficantes and the drug, I don't know what you call it, the circulation of pain. I feel like the way we've outsourced a lot of labor, we've outsourced our pain to Mexico. You know, that Americans consume huge amounts of drugs as a kind of anesthesia for whatever creates so much pain in this culture and so much despair. And of course, the drugs generate more. But it's also interesting that there's been no movement the way there has been with, you know, fair trade coffee or sweatshop free clothing or the things like that, or, you know, to not consume drugs that are produced at the cost of human life. And the way that it's one economy and based on the insatiable U.S. appetite for numbing yourself is one of the things, and it's one of the things that doesn't get talked about. It's often treated as though Mexico is this horrible mess that we should seal off with more border walls, rather than that what's going on down there is a lot of it is our mess, and it's a lot of it's instigated by us, not only because we're sending so many of the guns south, but because, you know, we're the voracious vacuum, you know, that sucking sound north of the border, you could call it, bringing all those drugs across. At so other questions or comments or at Yeah. Yeah, this is, you know, the General Assemblies were really the heart of the Occupy movement, and that was one of the things a lot of people didn't understand. And the media, you probably, some of you, most of you probably know that famous Gandhi dictum, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And with Occupy, there was all these different ways it was trivialized. First, it was, you know, it was sort of dismissed, and then it was as incoherent because what were their demands? And of course, their demands was that we somehow bring Wall Street to reckoning for destroying, doing everything in its power to destroy civilization and the earth as we know it, which seemed pretty clear to me. And but I think they wanted a 10-point list of, like, we want cookies and we want milk or whatever. They wanted, like, little some. But also that whole model was, like, we were asking them to give us things. And instead it was people saying, this is what we have. We have power, we have voice, we have each other. And we're not talking to you, to them, we're talking to ourselves. And it was this amazing conversation. And I met so many people who were so alive with the joy of feeling that they had that they could connect, that they had a voice, that they were being heard, that they were being respected. And so much of what the economic collapse has done is make people invisible. You lose your home, and the shame is so overwhelming, you just disappear. And then maybe you become, you know, the part of the forgotten population of the homeless and the semi-homeless couch surfers and car livers and things. You lose your job and you disappear from the workplace and you hang out at home if you still have one. You know, the depression has really made people disappear in so many ways. And this was a space in which people could appear, could find solidarity and kind of overcome that shame. And that happened a lot. One of the forms of occupation that's still going on is foreclosure defenses. We had one in San Francisco a week or two ago where they do this thing called two-tracking, where you think you're in honorable negotiations or you're all paid up, but they're actually processing all the stuff to foreclose on you without your knowledge. So suddenly, we had a case in San Francisco last year where a woman in her 70s who ran a daycare center out of her home took one of the kids to kindergarten, came back with other kids, and found out that the bank had locked her out of her home and wasn't going to let her pick up any diapers or medicine. You know, and we went and humiliated the bank in public until they let her back in. But so the General Assembly, though, was really about direct democracy. And democracy is this weird buzzword that, you know, I believe it was one of the things Bush pretended he was bringing to Iraq, which hadn't exactly asked us to bring it and didn't really think bombs were a great democracy delivery system. You know, and the idea is you go into the voting booth every 4 years and who cares who's been disenfranchised and who's, you know, how much, and you know all the ways democracy doesn't work in electoral politics in this country. But that experience of direct democracy where decisions are made collectively, I think is really important. And part of my hope really lies in the fact that, you know, things are incalculable. We don't know what the consequences of those experiences are. And a lot of people are still connected in their communities, are still meeting, are still organizing, are still doing foreclosure defenses or feeding the homeless. Some of them have won amazing victories in Rhode and Providence, for example. Occupy Providence agreed to disband only after the city opened a daytime homeless shelter. And so, like, every day that the homeless have a place to be in the daytime, you know, is an Occupy victory in Providence. So, but you also don't really know how people's lives get changed. And one of the things after a quarter century of activism is I often hear stories of people where something, you know, a seed was planted and it ripened much later. You know, it didn't bear fruit until much further down the road. And you don't know. And sometimes, and it's kind of great when you have an event and, like, in that very moment you bring, you know, you stop the foreclosure, you bring the bank to its knees, or you change the public story, and that happens sometimes. But also sometimes I think it's like some 13, you know, the next Martin Luther King or Aung San Suu Kyi, currently age 13, was in the crowd and is going to do something awesome in 20 years or something like that. So it's that kind of uncertainty. But the Occupy movement, for me, was just about how strongly people crave to live in a more honorable society, a more just society. And if you give them just a little taste of it, they light up. It felt very, you know, it happened a few years after I wrote about disaster in my Paradise Built in Hell. But what really got me writing about disaster is that it upends the whole, everything we've been told about human nature. All the crappy disaster movies, all the fucked up coverage of Hurricane Katrina and the Haitian earthquake and stuff, assume that we're basically creatures of Hobbes, we're nasty, brutish, and, you know, and incredibly self-interested, and that the only thing that protects us from each other is the institution, you know, is the authorities with their threat of always implicit and often explicit threat or deployment of violence, and that when the system collapses, when they goes away, we kind of revert to our natural selfish brutality. Well, my gender reverts to screaming and waving its arms helplessly and being hysterical. Your gender reverts to raping and pillaging. I'm not sure which one is better. And, you know, but what people actually do in disasters is generally, whether it's after 747s fly into your very tall office tower or your levees break and your city's 80% underwater, is pretty calm, generous, altruistic, and resourceful. And what I found over and over from the 1906 earthquake to Katrina was that people really found incredible joy and meaning in the ways they're able to find common ground, improvise the conditions of their survival, and sometimes find more meaningful work. It was about these desires we have that we don't even have a name for. I feel like we've privatized our psyches in so many ways. I was talking about some of them earlier, but we're constantly told about sex, love, family life, and stuff, that those are the four things we want. And when the love just means, like, you know, like the seven people closest to you or something. But people really want to be members of civil society. They want to live in public. They want democracy. They want to have a voice. They want agency. And they find it in a funny way sometimes after disaster. And the way that political upheaval and revolution and economic collapse resemble natural disaster is kind of remarkable. And the Occupy tent camps to me look so much like post-earthquake tent camps. And some of the same kinds of communities, soup kitchens, et cetera, formed. And, you know, and I feel like a lot of my work is about finding a language to describe what doesn't get talked about, finding a language to value the intangible and immeasurable over the quantifiable we hear about endlessly in advertisements, you know, the kind of commodifiable and the manufactured, and that these are moments where people suddenly are inventing the language or finding the conversation in which those things matter, in which even though they might not have a name for them, they might not have even known they craved them, they've suddenly found them. And in those moments, they light up with joy. And that's something I've been around over and over. And it's really extraordinary. And so we could just end there, or are there other questions? Yeah. Yeah.
You're talking about both coasts. It's a huge, huge movement in the West that is doing exactly.
Oh, I know. I was mentioning Wisconsin, which was Madison, which was so amazing, but.
But I've been doing this for over 15 years, and you talk about the hope. And I'm a grandmother now. Maybe not too long, I'll be a great grandmother. And what I see has happened is that it comes out greater and greater.
That what?
And you, as like you touch these people here, you touch people, they will touch other people.
Yeah.
And that thing of hope, I think, and it doesn't always span on bigger and bigger, but in the home and long term, it does.
Yeah. Exactly. I think all I'm saying is that the things that can't be measured also count, or that we need to learn to count them. So, and people are getting restless. Let's mill around aimlessly, and I'm happy to sign books. And thank you so much, Marpa.